Well, I'm very pleased to say I'm now joined by Greg Miller, who is Deputy Chair of Greyhound Racing Victoria in Australia. Good to see you, Greg, all that long way away. I know it's nighttime there, so thank you for joining us. Just start by telling people a little bit about yourself, so your professional background and also your role in Greyhound Racing now.
Great to see you too, Julie. Julie was a guest of ours at the Melbourne Cup many years ago and did a great job as an ambassador for Greyhound Racing in Great Britain. I, as a young kid, played a bit of footy. I had greyhounds. My father had greyhounds, and I then got involved with football. I played West Australian rules football, and then got involved with administration. And I ran a few clubs over here in Victoria, in the professional sense, for 38 odd years. On my retirement out of football, I joined the Sandown Greyhound Racing Club as their CEO, and was in that job for nearly 10 years. And Sandown is, you know, unashamedly would say one of the great clubs of the world and going very well. And the club that invited you over from England because we saw the talent that you had. And we then went to, I've now retired from my job as CEO of Sandown. And I'm of a government position that I'm on the board of Greyhound Racing Victoria. It's a government appointment here. And I'm the deputy chair. But I've been in love of greyhounds since a kid when my father raced them. I raced quite a few as a professional footballer. I had a number of my players racing greyhounds. Then had a 30-odd years away from the sport where I'd only go once or twice a year. And then now I'm in a position where I can hopefully assist the sport going forward.
So when you were professionally working in football and then you came into greyhound racing in Australia, you sort of came with a fresh set of eyes. Did you see things that you wanted to change immediately? Did you feel like you wanted to revolutionise greyhound racing, bring it more up to date or anything like that?
I think AFL football in Australia is massive. It's like, it's the biggest sport, number one sport. It's a completely unique sport, nothing like soccer, more like the Gaelic game, the Irish game. It's very big here. And we were a struggling club financially, and therefore we had to be entrepreneurial. We brought in Friday night football. We brought in different marketing concepts as we needed to. And we're a very successful club. We won the premiership on a number of occasions. And I think being forced in that situation, you pick up and learn things. And as soon as I got to greyhound racing, I saw things that I'd learned in my time in football. And I had a very supportive board. We're financially okay. And we were able to implement some of those marketing ideas. And responsibility the clubs have here in Australia in making sure the sport prospers. So I was able to bring those to the sport, things I learned in my administration days.
One thing that's important in this interview is that you have spent a lot of time here in the UK, also in Ireland, greyhound racing, as well as other countries of the world, New Zealand, America. Here in the UK, what do you think of greyhound racing as a whole? We'll delve deeper in certain aspects, but as a whole, what do you make of it?
Look, it's on a completely different level, and I mean that in Ireland, England, America, and I say that Australia does lead the way in its professional approach. We've got a system of financing our sport, which is unique and makes a big difference. But I love greyhound racing everywhere. I've been to the Irish Derby. I haven't been to the English Derby. I've been to the Irish Derby. I've been to major races in New Zealand and of course, in America. And I love the occasion, so don't get me wrong. The, you know, Shelburne Park and been all around. I took my wife and I got married in Ireland many years ago. And I took my children back and showed them where we got married in Ireland probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And on that 2-week trip, I think we went to about 8 dog meetings. So you see, I love the greyhounds. My wife's great. She enjoyed them too. My kids love the dog. But both my children work at Sandown in roles. Yeah. My son loves them and he works on the track and my daughter's in the catering area. So they've grown up now with greyhounds around them. But just going back to your question, I'm sorry to diverse there. I've been to White City and been to a number of tracks in England. It's just a completely, it's like our country tracks. they really are. Well, we've got some outback country tracks and they're pretty low key, and that's how I found racing in the UK and in Ireland in comparison. It's interesting in Ireland, and I assume it's the same in the UK, they're very family orientated, and it's about going and having a meal with your family. Well, I think in Australia, while that's a part of it, and I encourage it with how we had food offerings and everything else, it's very much a punting day out. And one of the things we did at Sandown was we funded clubs and groups to come to our venue, and we made it extremely cheap. So we were able to, again, through our whole funding system in Australia, we were able to pay and get buses and bring a lot of people to our events, a lot of people to our racetrack, and they were in groups. Whereas what I picked up in, particularly in the UK and in Ireland, was families going out for dinner, which is a good thing as well, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I think in Ireland, it's probably more so because the children are allowed to be involved at a much younger age in terms of handling the dogs, parading them and things like that. So it's much more a family thing in Ireland, definitely. The models are very different in Australia to here, aren't they? In terms of the governing bodies and the tracks. And I know you call them clubs, the tracks, just to clarify.
Yes.
I don't know. But just explain, you mentioned that your appointment is actually a government appointment. Explain how it all works.
Yeah, look, we're a government statutory body called Grand Racing Victoria. The appointment of our board is made by the racing minister here. And he appoints a chairman, and then he appointed me and a board of about five or six others who all have different expertise. And then, of course, we manage the full-time staff. But our model is such that that's Grand Racing Victoria, and they're the head office. But then we have 13 clubs. Each of those clubs are not-for-profit clubs. They have committees. They have CEOs, they have marketing people, they have track people, they employ people, and they're in regional areas of our state, which is called Victoria, and there are these two city tracks. And so we've got 13 clubs. Around Australia, there's probably 60-odd clubs, and New South Wales, Queensland, the other states have all got a similar model. So the independence of the clubs, now the clubs are financed, again, by the head body. So the head body raises all the income, mainly through betting, and they then distribute prize money. The bigger clubs like Sandown and the Meadows add to that prize money, so the prize money is even more than the GRV distribute. But we have a set grading system throughout the whole of our state, a set race fields, prize money. You also get transport money. Every trainer who brings his dog to the track gets $80 just for transport. So we look after the backyard trainer as well, so he's not out of pocket all the time. And we have different tier three or lower grade right up to the group racing. And that's the same throughout the whole of Australia. And we do have an Australian Greyhound Racing Association, which is called Greyhound Clubs Australia as well. So it's become, while each state is managed by their state racing board member, so the government appointed racing member, we still work as a national country for the betterment of our sport. So we work together on the GAP program, we work together on welfare and integrity and disclosures and everything else. So we're trying to work together as one, even though we've got different bosses in every state.
Mm. And I think an important thing to mention is this whole not-for-profit thing. Is that the clubs as well as the actual greyhound racing governing bodies?
Yeah, for sure. The clubs are just like any sporting club. They're made up of volunteer directors who employ a CEO, which I was at Sandown for 10 years. And then I engaged, we had a team of 17 or 18 staff. We had a couple of chefs and a couple of racing managers, a couple of track managers, marketing people, accounts people, and we ran not-for-profit, and we got money through events that we ran. We got money for holding races, and the GRV paid the club for holding an event, pays for all your staff, all your casual staff on a race day, and then if we made a profit at the end of the year, we put it back into more prize money.
Amazing.
Or we'd invest back in the industry, and in Sandown's case, we invested in rearing properties. We invested in syndications to broaden the base of people involved in our sport. So we had an obligation. Clubs have an obligation to invest back in the sport, but then because they're all not-for-profits. One more thing I might add here, luckily, in Victoria, of the 13 clubs, there's three or four who own their own land. They're not on Crown land. So they've actually got big asset bases as well. Mm.
Another thing I noticed when I was there, particularly working in the head offices, is that the people employed are not necessarily first and foremost greyhound racing lovers. They're more experts in their field, be it marketing or accounting or advertising, whatever it is, communications, PR, they're experts in their field. And then they become greyhound racing lovers through the job. How important do you think to have people who are experts in the job they're doing rather than actually they love
marketing? In many ways, it is a government department. So you've got IT experts, marketing experts, you've got a legal team. And you're right, they don't start off as greyhound enthusiasts. And in some ways, they're restricted from being greyhound enthusiasts because as a worker at GRV and as a board member, you're not allowed to bet on greyhounds. You're not allowed to own greyhounds. So their restrictions on falling in love with greyhounds is something that's been brought in, I guess, for compliance and integrity reasons. And I understand that. So but the clubs, they're all greyhound lovers. So you've got 13 clubs that employ a lot of people, a lot of casuals and a lot of full-time. They're all greyhound lovers. In a GRV, in a head office, it's a gradual process of having them appreciate the sport. That's one of my new jobs, to help that process.
So, Greg, we've touched on how the funding for Greyhound Racing Australia is so different. And most of that comes through TAB, which is essentially, for those who don't know, it's a bit like our tote. And that really dominates your betting market over there, less so than perhaps before. But just explain how the whole betting scenario works over there compared to here and how you get your income to Greyhound Racing and how much that is.
Okay, we have what's called a racing joint venture. And that's with the TAB, as you say. It comes up for renewal in 3 years' time, so the posturing's starting. But basically, that provides us with we share in the venture with them. So we get a percentage based on our turnover. And our grand racing turnover is about 23% of the total racing betting in Victoria, our state. So out of every $100, 23 is bet on greyhounds. About 63 or 64 bet on racehorses. And the balance is bet on the trots, the harness racing. But we're number two in that picture. So based on a percentage like that, we receive we enjoy the success of the TAB. It used to be 70-80% of our income used to come through that joint venture. But what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years is the growth in the corporate bookmakers has meant that we've grown a new source of revenue. We attract what's called a race field fee. So the Bet365 companies of this world, they pay for betting on our races, they'll pay us about 1.5% of their turnover. And that's built up because their success has been our success. Our revenue is about $100 million a year in Victoria, in our state, of which we pay about 50% of that in prize money. And then the rest of it goes to make sure the integrity, the welfare of our greyhounds, the integrity, the professional running of our organisation maintains that standard that we must maintain to make sure we've got the public's confidence and the government's confidence.
So I'm going to give you the comparison to here. We have a voluntary agreement, which to be fair is quite a new thing as well. This has recently been agreed by our new managing director of the GBGB, Mark Bird, 0.6% of turnover, and that's a voluntary contribution, so not all bookmakers pay it. I think next year, because we've just managed to agree it to come on online bets as well, we're hoping it might be somewhere in the region of 8.5 million.
Yeah. Well, Victoria alone is closer to 100 million, but we're selling our product worldwide as well. We're in the marketplace in America, throughout Europe and England. We'll get extra revenue as we sell out. If grand racing is reducing in America as it is, we want to put our racing code here in Victoria, in Australia, on the TV sets or in the casinos in America and earn another percentage of revenue.
Yeah.
So we're providing the product. We're spending the money on the product. And so we're trying to maximise our commercial opportunities for that product.
Yeah. Forward thinking. Betting is very different there as well. I mean, we don't have so much on-course betting as we used to, but actually there it's really minimal, isn't it? People are betting on their phones. And of course, you can go to the pub. Every pub you go to, you can have a bet in, which presumably generates you more income, because it seems to be even more of a cultural thing, betting in Australia, than it is here in the UK.
Yeah, probably you're right. The pubs here all have betting machines or operators, and you can put a bet on. And it's a sort of a mate thing to do in a pub. When you're in the pubs, you'll have a beer and you might pool some money and have a bet together. And during the recent COVID situation, the pubs were shut and the retail outlets, the betting shops were shut. So the income went down. But online betting became bigger. People on their phones and on their laptops, and they had more time at home, and the actual revenue increased. It's a different world over here in terms of the opportunities in your face all the time. But there is a change. There's a change away from onto the phones and tablets now. The retail outlets or the pubs, they'll probably decline. Even as a group at a pub, you might not walk over to a machine there. You might just get your phone.
Yeah.
So it's changing.
And how does it affect crowds? I mean, obviously, I came to the Melbourne Cup and you had a huge crowd. But what about the run-of-the-mill meetings? Do you get crowds at all?
Yeah, we do. It's an interesting... We because of our revenue base is pretty good, we subsidise our meals. And we subsidise with high customer service. One of the jobs of the clubs is to change perceptions on greyhound racing. I think people, when they come to Sandown and they see the quality of the venue, or they go to the meadows, or they go to some of the country tracks, and they see the quality of the venues, it changes perceptions. And then one of the roles of the clubs is to change perceptions, because that's what we're up against. We need, in Australia, like everywhere else in the world, it's a numbers game. It's getting the support of the government. And the way you get the support of the government is the support of the people. So Grand Racing Victoria spent a lot of money, a lot of staff, a lot of money on making sure the integrity of our sport, the welfare side of our sport, is number one priorities. Without that, we don't have the government's favour, we don't have the public's favour, and Grand Racing will cease. So there's a lot being done in that area. And the clubs have to play their role. They put on a lot of events. We have a lot of events for children and families and clubs and groups. And they do come in their numbers. And, clubs like Sandown, the Meadows, they race 104 times a year. Well, 30% of those will be an occasion. And they'll put something on, and they are subsidised too. And when you're subsidised, people see the value for money. They come in, we change their perceptions. And that's one of the roles of the clubs.
How does it filter down to prize money? Obviously, the Melbourne Cup, I'm sure you'll tell me how much it's worth now, but I know it's an incredible amount of money. And also to the lower end races, we call them our graded races here. What's the prize money?
Well, in Victoria, it's around $50 million. And then around Australia, I'm not sure the total figure, but New South Wales would be similar. And then we've got Queensland and other states. And the prize money, an average city race, is the winner gets about $5,000 Australian. But then we have a lot of group races. And the lowest, at the other end, the country standards race is $1,400 to the winner. But we also have transport money. So every trainer who brings his dog to the track receives $80 when he arrives, and that's his transport. And we're making sure that we keep a wide base of people in our sport. The backyard trainer is just as important to us as the big stable, because we need a base of people involved. And we've got plenty of people in our state who train one or two dogs in their backyard. Now, they're still subject to the same inspections of their kennels and their facilities and how they must, the code of practice and how they look after their dogs and everything else.
Yeah.
We have a lot of officers who go out and examine every property, from the properties with 200 dogs to the properties with one dog. And that's a very important part of being totally transparent with the RSPCA over here, the animal activist groups. We have all of that work that we do on a welfare front, and we lay it bare every year in our annual report, exactly what's happening in our sport, so we're totally transparent. That's a really important part of maintaining the government's confidence and making sure that our industry not only survives, but prospers.
So $5,000, your base rate prize money. I think our lowest sort of prize money would be around £60 for a low graded race. It might even be lower than that in places, but it's very
expensive. Look, it's a different funding model.
It is.
You know, the bookmakers and the TAB know they've got to contribute, and it works for horses as well. Our prize money in our horse racing, our greyhound racing, our harness racing would be, you know, as good as anything in the world, probably barring Hong Kong or Japan, but certainly greyhound racing would be nothing like it, you know.
And how does it filter down, Greg, to the trainers? You mentioned they get bits of money here and there, but in terms of kennel bills, do they charge their owners a fee per day, or how does that work?
No, not at all. We very much work on a 50-50 basis. So we encourage ownership. We've encouraged syndications. We work very hard on ownership because, again, that broad people involved in our sports, going to the numbers are very important for government to understand the depth of our industry. If I may just digress a little bit, we had a problem in New South Wales, our sister state, where the Premier said he didn't like greyhound racing and he said, I'm stopping it next year. Well, you know, he got thrown out of government because the numbers in the country and regional areas were so in favour of greyhound racing and thought they were being attacked. The regional areas felt that their livelihood or their culture was being attacked, and he got thrown out of government. So that's important that we maintain our broad base of people involved through ownership and trainers. So what happens if you own a dog or you buy a syndication share, you give it to a trainer, you go 50-50. If there's a $5,000 prize, $2,500 will get sent to him and $2,500 will get sent to the owner. And
there's no, you know, he doesn't, bill to pay for the owner.
No bills. There's no bills at all. You have a rehoming contingency. There's a responsibility back on the owner to rehome, and they all know that. That's a very, very important part of the system that we have here, the rehoming, and the owners understand that. But you'll find with syndications, and we've found this already, with syndication, amongst the 10, 20 people in the syndicate, there'll be someone there who wants a dog. If not, our GAP program is extremely strong.
Yeah, we'll touch more on that later. Do you have a lot of trainer-owned dogs then?
Yeah, we do. We have owner trainers. But an owner trainer might have a couple for himself, and he then realise, you know, that he needs financially improve his kennel, and he'll take on owners. Yeah, there's a mixture. There's certainly a lot more professional trainers. The bigger ones are all professional, and they race for owners pay the original bills, because if you buy a young pup for $3,000. By the time he gets to the racetrack, you're talking $15,000 or $17,000.
Yeah.
You know, with all the rearing and the preparation to racing. And the minute that $17,000 is spent, from that minute on, you've got to win $34,000 to break square. And that's what's happening over here with the good prize money and your well-placed dogs and the opportunities, because we have 23 race meetings a week in our state. And we're looking to expand that to 24 and 25. So there's an opportunity for our dog population to race anywhere and get some prize money and some travel money. And they do. They'll race at one track one day and 5 days later somewhere else, and they move around. And we have a grading system that allows them to go up and down the grades and compete against a dog of similar ability. And that's really important as well for also not only them to give them a chance to win money, it's very important for the punting dollar that we've got some even fields so that the punters can use their skill and back a winner, and that encourages encourages the form guides and the social media discussion on greyhounds, and the betting side is enhanced by that.
Again, that's a stark difference to here in the UK, in that you've got 23 tracks racing, so 13 tracks 23 times
yeah.
a week. Our tracks are right. far more than that, maybe have 4 or 5 meetings a week each, so we have less funds, less resources being spread much more thinly than you have. My final question here on this part is, and it's a tricky one, but obviously to implement it would have to be very different, but do you think there's any way that your model can be implemented here at all, albeit if it's not done at a government level? Do you think that, you know, there's any way that we can get those sort of levels of money in, or is that unlikely?
Well, you would hope that the appetite of the betting agencies is to make sure the survival of their product. And it's beholden on them to invest in their product that they're making money out of. Now, if you say it's not compulsory, well, you know, look, I know the bookmakers here pay a race bills fee to horses, harness, and to greyhound racing, but they'll get free betting on the NBA or American sport, for example. Therefore, they'll promote that more than us because they're not paying the race fields fee.
Yeah.
So you've got a, you know, they've got an obligation. If they want to lay the odds to pay the people who are running the sport, and perhaps, you know, we're blessed, and I think in your case, it's not good. And if they start losing product, I know there's been an interesting time, Julie, that we've been through over here in during that COVID period where there was no sport, betting on greyhound racing went right up. As sport came back in, the younger generation stayed with our sport, stayed with greyhound racing. We didn't lose a lot quickly that you thought you might when American sport or our own sport over here come back online. And I think that's because greyhound racing is a fast, quick payout, no correct weights, no protests, and it's all over in 40 seconds. And I think that's attractive to the younger generation.
So some people here, Greg, in the UK are actually turning to greyhound racing Australia as owners. Most notably, we have our blue tick syndicate here that are owning plenty of dogs over there. Do you have plenty of owners over there? Is it something that you need more of? And how easy is it to own dogs in Australia?
Well, it's very easy in Australia because we have a number of syndicators. And I mentioned before about the Sandown Club, and they syndicate. And it's a cheaper sport to get involved in than horses because you're not paying a weekly fee. Once you paid your fee up the front and you get a 50-50 basis for the prize money, there's no more to pay. So that's an advertising opportunity. You can also advertise the Melbourne Cup, the Australian Cup, and the amount of prize money at the top end. And you can advertise the fact that we have greyhounds, quite a few now, who win over $1 million. So we can advertise all those things. And we can get people involved through syndication, so through small investments. So ownership's vital. And what's been picked up with Blue Tick and others overseas is that Australian prize money is good, and you can have the same thrill by watching it on your tablets and everything else. And you may even get them to come out like you did one day and watch their own dogs race. So look, I think it's an increasing opportunity. One thing we do have here, we're very all owners have to be. Australia, living in Australia, so you have to come through a syndication model because of the welfare. We're very particular on what countries we deal with and how we allow the traffic of dogs. They have to go to countries that have a welfare policy. And the same with owners. We can't have an owner from the middle of England who takes his dog back and then sends it to a country that doesn't have a welfare policy. So, but there's ways to work within those rules. By having an association with, as Luke Dick's done, with a great guy called, you know, there's many other opportunities in Australia to race greyhounds. And you know, I remember back in Sandown days, we bought some dogs out from Ireland with Dolores Ruth. She sent some greyhounds out to Kel and to us. And the opportunity's there if anyone wants to get involved.
Oh, definitely, that two-way relationship I'd love to see more of. I think there's many of us that would. Is it quite feasible then as an owner in Australia that you would actually make money?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, of course you can. I mean, with the level of prize money, look, you don't go in thinking you're going to make money. You go in to have the fun and everything else. But along the way, you know, you can be lucky. A quick story, if I may. My daughter had a greyhound when she was young. She loved them. So her and her girlfriend bought a dog, and it won $30,000. Australian dollars, and she's got money in the bank now. She's donating and use it to buy a car. My son got jealous. I bought him a dog, and he's now laying on my couch. He never even got the racetrack. He's cost me $30,000. But that's the thrill of racing. You know, she's done well, and there's opportunities. Sure, there is, and there's some professional owners out here. There's a guy called Ray Border over here who's got a lot of dogs, and he's made good money. Good on him. Good on him. And if they're very good, they become stud dogs and you make even more money.
Yeah, of course. I'm told as well by some of the professional punters over here that were betting on Australian greyhound racing during our lockdown that it's a bit easier to find a winner over there apparently as well. So maybe that's another route to earn some money. Do you have the same problems with anti-racing people over there that we do? We have a really strong group of people that seem to be able to make a lot of noise over here.
Yeah, they do make a lot of noise. And Grand Racing Victoria has done very well is being totally transparent with everything. And I think that takes the heat out of it. If you tell the truth and you know the truth, you've got to know your facts and figures. So Grand Racing has done very well with its integrity, the belief in our sport by the punter. That keeps the punter betting on our sport because of the high level of integrity. We've got a lot of stewards, a lot of people investigating, a lot of covert operations behind the scenes, making sure no one's doing the wrong thing. High level of integrity is absolutely vital. And the other thing, the RSPCA was called the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in Australia, and there's other groups. We've actually brought them into our tent and explained to them what we're doing. And as I say, being transparent with everything we're doing. There's no doubt that the Achilles heel for greyhound racing is still track injuries. Before this COVID administration was in play for the last 4 or 5 years, euthanasia was a problem. It's not anymore because of the high level of highly successful GAP program, which is extremely popular over here. But track injuries, so the amount of money that Greyhound Racing Victoria and Greyhound Racing Australia spend on mitigating and lessening track accidents is so important. And I often say this, to keep greyhound racing going, if we've got to run on padded lanes in a straight race, we will. You have to do what you have to do. Mm. At the moment, they've worked very hard on having a lure out more in the middle of the track, and they're looking at preferential box draws, the candor on the track, on the turns, and where you put your starting boxes, and all of these things, and the sands, and the surface level, and the consistency from track to track to track, day to day to day of the tracks. You need professional people, you need money to keep working on these tracks to lessen track injuries. And that's pretty much what's happening here in Australia.
In all walks of life, Greg, you get bad eggs in every sport for sure, certainly where there's gambling involved. How Yes. do you deal with those people? Let's say there was a trainer who wasn't doing things right or the way, you know, looking after the dogs. Mm. How would you deal with those sorts of people?
Well, it's luckily I can tell you that I think the industry is coming a little bit self-regulating. What's happened, we had a bad situation here 4 or 5 years ago, some live baiting, and the industry was at threat. New South Wales.
That's here, by the way. We heard all about that here.
Sure. And I think the GRV employed a lot of investigators and a lot of really smart COVID operations behind the scenes in monitoring what was going on out there in trainer land. But also, people encouraged to drop us a line and tell us what was going on. We had opportunities for you, as they say, it's not an Australian way, but it had to be because the industry was under threat unless you were honest, unless you dobbed in someone or you made it repugnant amongst each other when you were talking to do the wrong thing. And that's been the change in the whole attitude. And look, I'm not saying there's still not, 5% who push the barrel and do the wrong thing, but the amount of testing that's done pre-race, in the car parks, post-race, after-race, at the kennels, the testing's done all the time, the operations behind the scene for what's going on, and then the information we're getting from other people in the industry to make sure our industry stays, strong, stays true, has helped self-regulate a little bit. I reckon we're doing okay in that area. Cross fingers, because we can't afford another TV story about a wrong person, because they're only a small minority in the industry and we've got to stamp them out.
So a wrong person, just to be clear.
Yeah.
And get rid of them?
Be pardoned?
Would you ban them? Are they out?
Oh no, they get life, they get 5 years, they get 10 years. They get, the penalties are very strict and very strong, and there's no correspondence into do the wrong thing, you're charged, and you follow it up. And you can't go to the racetracks. You can't own dogs. You can't train dogs. And there's been a change. There's been a change in the last 4 or 5 years. And we've probably got less trainers than we used to because they're now held more accountable. That's good. A good thing.
It's definitely good. And as a result of that, I mean, even going back the 4 or 5 years when I was there, one thing that struck me is how proud you all are of your sport and how proud you are of the dogs. You really showcase the dogs. You're transparent in that you're able to see them being checked by the vet pre-racing. But there really is this kind of attitude of we're proud of our sport, which we have here to an extent, but not as much as I saw there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you picked that up because, I feel that while we're only a minor sport in comparison to some others, there's a long, strong history in Australia of greyhound racing, and it's gone from generation to generation. There's a lot of family interest in it as well, you know, and we encourage those stories of the family-owned greyhounds and the family coming and watching their dog. And I talked about my daughter before, who loves the greyhounds. You know, I think those things are all good. They're good, wholesome family things to do. We do love our dog, and we do promote the champions, and we promote the family interests. We promote all those things, and we get a little bit of media coverage, not a lot, but we also do a lot of our own media too, you know, especially with social media now. We do a lot of our own social media. So,
yep. And you say not a lot of media, but it's certainly more than we get here. So you would be on radio stations regularly, and also you still have Sky Racing, don't you, which we sadly miss.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We have, just in Melbourne, the capital city here, we have two radio stations broadcasting races. One's a new one. It's called SEN Track, and it just concentrates on greyhounds and horses, and it tells a story, and it's got time to tell a story. And it's going well. And it's also got a lot of young people involved, and they talk the language now that we need, that language that young people like to hear and can engage with and bet. You know, get the confidence of those people they're listening to bet on our sport. And so in that regard, we do get a bit of media coverage, and we do create our own, and we do pay for our own. We do a lot of advertising too. And again, with that money situation we have, we spend money back with these radio stations and TV stations to make sure our voice is heard, our story's told.
Which really works. It's a great idea. I just want to finish this part by indulging both of us really and just reliving the night at the Melbourne Cup that I was there. So much more than just dog racing. There was so much more going on. I think I remember you spinning a wheel with a lady who could have won £100,000 or something. And she got close.
Yeah,
another Sunday. I mean, there was motorbikes flying through the air. There was fireworks, which we wouldn't have at a dog track, but it didn't seem to bother anyone. There was oyster bars. There was just endless things going on. And the competition itself, I should say, two runs, for those who don't know, two runs. And what's the first prize?
The Melbourne Cup then, when you were there, might have been about $500,000 to the winner. I can't remember what that. It's up in that sort of realm. You know, the plan is to increase that in the next few years, probably held up a little bit by the COVID situation. But they had a plan there to get a new series called the Diamond Series, which is a collaborative series around Australia, lifting above Group 1 to another level of prize money. And the prize money is good. The atmosphere, the Melbourne Cup's a tradition over here. Like the horses, the Greyhound Melbourne Cup, the Australian Cup at the Meadows, they're fantastic nights out. Big, big crowds. You can't fit any more people in. I think 2 years ago, I think we did about 900 for dinner. In different marquees and everything else. So, it's a big betting night too. They bet, and we have a lot of competition. A lot of fun. Take a lot of work, and I've done my last one in 2019.
Well, Greg, we've touched quite a lot on how important welfare is in greyhound racing. I think probably the most important aspect across the world for greyhound racing is to survive and prosper. But I want to talk a little bit more about your GAP program, which is probably the equivalent of our Greyhound Trust here. Tell us about your adoption days, first of all.
Oh, yeah, we do. We have a national adoption day around Australia where all the GAP programs from every state work together. And that's on one day, and it's promoted over here heavily. But in Victoria alone, we have adoption days at our major clubs. And what we do is we might have 150 greyhounds or 100 greyhounds, and they're put in different sections around the bigger buildings we have here, the bigger racetracks. And you might go along looking for a greyhound that likes to be with a young family. Or you go to one spot and there's seven or eight to choose from there. Or you might want a greyhound that doesn't mind living with cats or needs attention every day. You know, there's different personalities, and we sectionalise them. And the crowds come in. We have fantastic days where the crowds come in. And, you know, you'll see 150, 200 greyhounds adopted on the one day, and people go home disappointed and waiting for the next one. We also have venues throughout the state where you can go up and you can choose a dog. We also, I think what's happened is that the dogs have got to go through, when the greyhound finishes racing, there's a real responsibility and a real clear knowledge that the owner's responsible for rehoming that dog. And so he takes along for what's called a GAP testing day. And sometimes the personality of the dog struggles under those tests, And they put him with little puppy dogs and everything else. And if they fail the test, they're not forgotten. They're then helped train. They're given ways of desensitizing the dog back to be able to live in the right environment. And we also have categories of greyhounds. They then go up to different farms and they get more training. And then they're desexed always. And then the price to take one home is, compared to other pure breeds, is so cheap. They've become extremely popular around Australia. They're in my little suburb here of Sandringham. When I walk my greyhound, I see other greyhounds all the time. They're everywhere, which is a great thing because they're, as you know, with one on your couch there, yeah. And I know with one on my couch, they're fantastic pets. And it's interesting, we promote that on a lot of our radio interview opportunities. And the feedback we get when we measure the public's perception of greyhound racing is that they're very aware that what used to be an issue with euthanasia is now no longer an issue. But the GAP program has made a big difference on that welfare front. So we've spent a lot of time, a lot of money, and it works extremely well throughout Australia, the GAP program, because, you know, there's responsible breeding. And having the right, just that balance of right numbers to race to 23 race meetings a week, getting that balance right.
Yeah.
And then at the other end, you've got to be able to make sure you can rehome them. Well, we've done an extremely good job of that around Australia. I guess as I said, but in terms of welfare, we're also spending a lot of money on racetracks, making sure they're as safe as they could possibly be. Yeah. And there's a lot of different work going on in that area.
You mentioned a couple of times the onus is on the owners to essentially take care of a dog in its retirement. I think we've got a bit of a problem here with that, which is going to be addressed because we're going to have a bond brought out by the governing body that you have to pay to register a racing greyhound. I think it'll be something like £200, which will be matched by the governing body, and that will go towards a dog's retirement. But how do you impose this thing where the owners are responsible for their dog?
We track every dog. Every dog is tracked.
So if an owner said I was paying for that dog's retirement, what would you do?
The fact is that when a dog is retired from racing, GRB will contact you and say, where's the dog now? The tracking of the dogs is so precise now, until it's rehomed, until it's gone to a rehome and that's both parties are signed off on it, you're responsible. And the GRB want to know where that dog is. So we've got a very exact system, and that's that transparency I was talking about, where, you know, if we're questioned by one of the groups that will help, or the Illibus, we can explain where every dog is. That's a very important part. So the owners now understand, if you want to invest in a dog, like with the syndications of Sandown Run, there's a contingency in what you pay for rehoming. There's money put aside to send that dog away. Part of the fee you're paying, if you're paying $15,000 for a dog, there's $1,000 put aside that's kept aside until the dog's rehomed. So it's all part of the
what's happening here. That's good.
Yeah.
For me, to attract a new generation to the sport, the welfare basically has to be perfect, I'd say. Pretty much perfect. Would you agree?
I totally. Without that, the next generation won't accept racing.
Yeah.
And they won't accept horse racing using a whip. They won't accept horses going to knackeries either. It's all changing, and so it should.
Yeah. I know it's a very important thing to you, how to attract the new generation. What else can we do to attract a new breed of people to the sport?
What we're doing here with tour, we've had a number of different concepts. Certainly getting the races on quickly, like 4-hour race meetings are ridiculous. You've got to try and get them to 3-hour race meetings or 2.5-hour race meetings. But you need Sky Channel, who's showing them on TV, to give you the right time slots. You then have the betting opportunities have got to be varied and different. And now we have quickest first splits and dog against dog and match racing and things that are like a sporting event. They look at a sporting event and it's, you know, Everton versus Manchester United. Well, it can be dog A versus dog B within a race, or it can be dog A versus dog B in a match race. So you're putting your sport, like the younger generation are judging what they bet on. And they'll do multis. And a multi you can do in greyhounds if the betting styles are there. Like the win and place, the parimutuel betting is on the way out. And new betting types where the new generation can bet with are on the way in. So you've got to provide those opportunities. You've got to get the races on in quick fire fashion. You've got to pay out straight away. you know, I guess there's some of the thoughts that we've had. And you've got to make it, you've got to have good vision so you can see them on track. And you've got to have betting opportunities in front of you all the time. I think we do that okay, but we're always trying new things.
I love your speed star racing where, you know, I mean, if you said to me, who's the fastest dog in the country, I'd love to be able to give you an official answer through the match racing. I think that's definitely something.
Well, you can. Yeah, it's definitely well.
You also do something else really well. And again, this comes under press coverage a little bit, but you tell stories, be them human interests or canine interests. There seems to be a story almost in every race. And I think you believe that storytelling is important.
Oh, absolutely it is. And we've got more and more opportunities to do that now. We've got radio stations and, you know, a few newspapers, but social media gives you that opportunity as well. And you've got to make stars of the sport. You've got to get people excited about your sport. So, you know, there's a dog at the moment called Simon Told Helen. And the history behind that is fantastic. And like, you know, he hid it from his wife. And who told his wife he had a dog? And then they named the dog Simon Told Helen. That's how the wife found out about the dog. Those sort of stories we tell well. We tell the family ownership stories, and we have opportunities to do that, and social media has only given us a greater opportunity. It's very, very important you celebrate the stars of your sport and you celebrate the great achievements of the sport like we do with every other sport. So we're not we don't hide from the stars. We don't hide from the dogs that win 5 or 6 in a row, or the dog that's won his first race out of 100 starts. They're all stories to tell that engage the people who are reading them in your sport. And it's incredible, you know, Mick Floyd, the racing manager here at Sandown, he loves telling stories. And the things he tells me are the most interesting stories, are those quirky little things. And they get massive hits on social media and they get shared, you know, worldwide. And that's good. You've got to make your sport like that. You've got to make your sport exciting, and talkability is so important in your sport.
Everybody enjoys those stories, and I think that's a massive thing. Dare I say, ladies might enjoy the human interest stories more, but this is an area that you really focus on, isn't it? Getting more ladies involved in greyhound racing.
Oh, it's so important for the, again, that the perception of our sport. It used to be that old man, you know, standing around the gas burner, you know, in his 70s or 80s. This is not the case in Australia. We have many, many ladies involved with our sport. The chairman of Grand Racing of Victoria, a lady called Peter Duncan, who's passionate about our sport, and she's the chairman of our sport. And we've got on our board, we've got 3 ladies. The clubs are run by ladies. The lady trainers, they're everywhere. We've got heaps of lady trainers. Angela Langton, she's the flavour of the month. She's leading training premiership at the moment, you know. And a lovely woman she is. And yeah, we encourage it. There's special races for lady trainers, and we have lady days and everything else that I'll try to get you to come to. But no, it is. It's a family sport. It's an equal lady sport. And the perception that it was an old man sport, we've got to change that perception, because it's not true.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. Right, I've been building up to this question. Within the constraints that we have, right, if you were in charge here, Greg, what would you do? What would you do differently? What would you put in place? What would you do?
Oh, look, I go back to the question you asked me about the obligation for the betting shops to contribute to your sport and what support you can get from government in that regard. I don't know how you'd go about that, but it seems to me that unless you've got the money, I mean, you've got a couple of entrepreneurs who have, you know, put their hand in the pocket. Well, that doesn't last forever. And pockets, you know, can become shallow all of a sudden. You can't rely on entrepreneurs. You've got to have a system in place that where those benefiting from your sport contribute. And I don't think they are. It sounds like they're not. So I don't know how I'd go about it, but yeah, no, that's because you need money to make sure that the, you know, and all of the things that I've talked about, the opportunity to attract people to your sport, the whole welfare, the whole integrity, costs money. You've got to have inspectors out there. You got to get the confidence in the punting. Then you've got to have integrity officers out there watching what's going on, to making sure that if you're a punter, you trust that every dog's running on its merits equally, have equal opportunity. And as soon as that's gone, you won't get the punting dollar. So, but to do that, again, you need money, you need inspectors, you need help, you need government help. And ultimately, you know, these private bookmaking companies, these betting shops, they've got to make a contribution to your race fields.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have to say that Mark Baird, who is our managing director, he's made great strides compared to previous people who were in charge on the welfare front and on getting some money in anyway. But I agree with you. I think there's no other business I can think of that doesn't invest in its products. And okay, we're getting some money in, but you've made it very clear. Our resources are so much fewer and spread so much further than yours are. And look how your sport's thriving and ours, I wouldn't say it's thriving at the moment. I mean, we've had two tracks close recently as a result of the corona pandemic. So yeah, it's, you know, we're trying, but it feels like we're always fighting at a sort of a bit of a losing battle. What about in Australia? What are you looking to achieve there? Is there anything on your agenda?
Well, yeah, there is an agenda item that we're put on hold that you'd be pleased to know, and that's assistance worldwide. I think Australia's got to help, and we've got to have a worldwide look at it. It's not good enough for Victoria to be strong and the rest of Australia not to be strong. Australia's got to be strong. It's not good enough for Australia to be strong and grand racing in demise around the rest of the world. We've got to help each other. And there's been suggestions that Australia should be making a greater contribution to assisting other countries. So, you know, we can't have it diminishing everywhere else and strong here. And we can't, there's situations throughout Europe where grand racing is actually, there's more grand racing in some of the Scandinavian countries, you know, in Pakistan and India, but they don't have welfare programs. You know, us here in the world who spend some money and who assist some of those countries get proper welfare programs. So if I can see that, you know, in time, Australia's got to reach out and help. Victoria's got to help the rest of Australia, which it is, and then Australia's got to help the rest of the world.
What an amazing position for you to be in. Greg, you've been so interesting to talk to. I'm sure everybody watching this will agree. It's been brilliant to catch up with you. And just want to finish by saying, if you would ever like to invite me to Melbourne again, I am more than willing to come back. I absolutely love my time there. And that's the final thing I would say. Anybody watching this, do get yourselves out there when travel restrictions are lifted and everything, because it's a great night out. Melbourne Cup or generally going greyhound racing there. And you make welcome, don't you?
Yeah, I'm not sure all your listeners would know, but when you did come out to the Melbourne Cup, you impressed everyone so much that I try to get you to stay. but no, it was a wrong time. But you never know. You're delighted. Thank you very much for being involved in our sport over in England.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'll speak to you again soon. But for the interview, thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Star Sports TV, our weekly magazine TV programme packed with tips, news and banter on the key sports events of the week. Check out the latest episode at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.